I'm going to start today's episode by quoting Madonna. You heard me right. In her year 2000 album, Music, the title track, you know the one, it has Ali G driving Madonna and her friends all over town in the music video. She states, "Music makes the people come together. Music mixed the bourgeoisie and the rebel." The Material Girl is absolutely right. The timing of this track and album couldn't have been better, as it acts as a review of how popular music has functioned in society for at least 100 years, but probably a lot more. This episode is cobbled together from a series of interviews I had with drop-in guests during podcast karaoke events over the last few months, putting them in order based on the time period of the subject material. First up, my conversation with Steve this past summer at the American Independence Museum in Exeter, New Hampshire. We talked about something well before Madonna hit the airwaves.
We can start with the sheet music itself. It's a nice, large piece of sheet music. Looks like it's suitable for multiple people looking at it at any one time. And this one, and it's what's interesting about this is that it has, this is I think the general score of it, but they have on the front an indication that they have other versions for multiple different settings, like piano two hands, piano four hands, orchestra, military band. I was in a military school band when I was away at school. I played French horn. And I really liked playing some of these great marches, like Anchors Away.
And the French horn is like the best instrument to be in a military band with, because it has that, they oftentimes feature it on insignia for, you know, it has that like almost like a military look to it. It's
right.
That's kind of perfect. So
yeah. So this also has zither, duet, mandolin solo, mandolins and piano, mandolins and guitar solo, banjo solo. So it shows you that this is like a very patriotic song, meant to be played in many different ways. The Stars and Stripes Forever, talking about the flag, obviously.
Yeah.
And, honoring the flag. This is, I'm wondering if it says this is copyright 1897. I gather that might be the year that it first came out.
And it would be correct to, because that's like, when those ideas of American imperialism were first really showing up, where, you know, that's the year before the Spanish-American War. Hawaii had already been, through the Dole Company, pretty much colonized by the United States. And so, this doesn't have lyrics in it, because Stars and Stripes Forever doesn't have lyrics. It's just music. But it's, you kind of wonder, maybe the leanings of John Philip Sousa, if he was a pro-American expansion or against it, what was he trying to communicate through the song? Stars and Stripes Forever, as in Continental United States Forever, or Stars and Stripes, you know, that saying, like, the sun never sets on the, you know,
the British Empire, and then
ours.
We had our own imperialism going on back. Yeah, so 1897. This would be right about the time of the Spanish-American War.
Just before, yeah.
So there could be something related to that he was trying to, you know, drum up patriotic sentiment for
right.
the. By the way, you know the tune da 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 da. There it is.
So I've never learned sheet music. I know chords. I can do like A and C, you know, very basic.
On guitar?
On guitar and bass and stuff like that. But that's such a good point. This came from a stack, and I'm not kidding, of at least 100 pieces of sheet music. Of all sorts, all varieties. It stands out from those ones because the other ones, most of them come from the 19-teens and the 1920s, where the graphics on the cover are a lot more eye-catching.
Right.
Whereas in this time period, I don't know if they're limited in what they could include on the cover, but it's the other ones from the 1890s are all pretty much the same cover, just, you know, different titles of things. And so I'm assuming by having just so much sheet music out there, it probably tells that, you know, unlike nowadays, a lot of people could, you know, you have all the different, I'm glad you pointed that out, about all the different kinds of instruments out there, but also that people could read music. And yes, that was probably because in the absence of other forms of entertainment, that was your entertainment. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, in the parlor or, it, you know, an event kind of like we're at today where, you know, people would play music for enjoyment.
Exactly. And almost every parlor in or living room in someone's house had a piano.
Right.
The piano was like a standard thing. And, you know, they have, for example, the Langdon House from Portsmouth. They have a wonderful, you know, spinet piano there. And they have, when I went to visit the Emily Dickinson House, they had the piano, a version, apparently, that the type that she played. And
it was like no question at all. Like, you know how to play music. Like, somebody in this house knows how to play, you know, piano or some kind of instrument.
And then you'd need a big piece of music like this, like that big printed piece for people to look on.
Yeah.
To sing along or to play with the piano tune. This looks very suitable for piano. There'll be usually left hand is lower, the bass clef, and right hand. I'm trying to learn piano myself. I'm taking, I got the Alfred Piano Book for Adult number 1. Mm. I've been taking a very long time, but hopefully at the end of the year I'll finish it. But they have great, you know, classic tunes, you know, everything from spirituals to hymns to, you know, music, you know, that type of thing.
It seems I think like the attitude such as yourself of, you know, like Renaissance, like want to learn how to do things and it's not as common nowadays. So I applaud you for it. Seems like it was probably more like, have you ever seen like elementary school or even especially like a high school exam from like the 1890s where, I mean, they had like Latin was expected of
Latin,
kids
Greek.
To know, and you had to do all these, and you know, you were looking at some of these history books that I have. I mean, they are just, it's just, you know, there are some images like maps and things, but it's just basically paragraph after paragraph just walking you through it's not, you know, they don't have little special sections like did you know or, you know, flashback to the past,
and the prose wasn't dumbed down. It was very, you know,
it was very
adult like what they weren't writing for, they expect the kids to step up to the plate and read proper English and all that.
Where does music fall into that late 19th century landscape of, you know, because by that point you know, colonial revivalism had arrived, you know, with the centennial in 1876. You had more people, especially in the upper classes, you know, really kind of concentrating on, you know, the kind of a narrow view of history, and that's where a lot of those house museums came from, like you were mentioning, like Langdon House and in Portsmouth and, you know, places like this where you could walk into the past. People were kind of struggling with the idea of America. Should we stay to North America, expand? You know, what does it mean to be an American with more immigrants coming into the country? Where do you think music, especially the Sousa marches, where does that fall in to that time period?
Well, it could be speculation on my part, but I think that probably with the expansion, they wanted to drum up this sentiment of the country being special, and if we have to go out and do some adventurism, maybe fight a war, then they want to get that sense of standing behind the flag, patriotism, and build up the image of the Americans as being courageous out there, and in their minds, I think that they didn't think that they were, doing anything wrong in terms of, fighting the Spanish during the Spanish-American War or,
I think a lot of people.
And the westward expansion, that type of thing. They thought it was a great thing, so.
That generation, which oftentimes gets overlooked because they weren't the Civil War generation, they came after that, so people like Theodore Roosevelt, who was far too young, I don't even know if he was alive by the time the Civil War ended, young guy in the late 19th century, he was very much in favor of American imperialism. He liked that idea of the country, sweeping from not just sea to shining sea, but across the entire globe. And it was And people that ended up being anti-imperialist were very much pro, get the Spanish out of the Philippines, get the Spanish out of Cuba, because they saw that our country's birth, which we're celebrating right now, as, you know, anti-colonialism. You know, people should be able to govern for themselves. So they were on board with that idea of the Cubans governing themselves, the Filipinos governing themselves.
To establish our form of government.
But then when the United States troops stayed, that's when the division in the culture really, you know, we had people like Mark Twain, you know, who was an outspoken anti-imperialist. And so I am curious, you know, I would, after we're done with this, I'll look it up maybe about what John Philip Sousa's, I know he was from Washington. Okay. You know, he grew up in Washington, so he was probably influenced by Washington politics his whole life, which after the Civil War, which is when he grew up, it was, you know, very much a growing Washington power structure. So I would be curious, though, where he falls on his politics. He's obviously very patriotic, otherwise he wouldn't have written all these marches. But, you know, where he stood on the imperialism question, I think would be interesting to find out.
You could still be patriotic and not be in favor of total expansion that we were doing. But another lesser known composer, if you're interested, to recommend, kind of on the same theme, is Louis Moreau Gottschalk, who was a pianist, composer, a little bit of some African-American, like a Creole extraction. And he had these massive events, which a lot of times were patriotic, and they had multiple, like some huge groups of pianos all playing together, this amazing music. And he's not as well known as that, but they had a kind of, you know, American sort of patriotic theme to them. I think he did one for, you know, like the 4th of July, big celebration, but just imagine like some like 12 or more pianos all playing together in different
and bigger than Elton John and Billy Joel when they do their dual piano thing.
Shows you the importance of the piano, which, you know, there's so many piano makers during that time period slowly that they've, you know, there's the Baldwin, the Chickering, they had all these different pianos that, you know, again, every household pretty much had one of any means, but such is not the case today.
Yeah, you can find them for free all the time on Facebook Marketplace and elsewhere, because I think that ability has just kind of gone away.
Yeah.
People have favored things like guitars, you know, over the piano because they're far more mobile. But yeah, they used to be
ukulele. Let me see. Doesn't have an ukulele here?
It does. No. Yeah, I think I know it's a banjo.
Mandolin, zither. I don't see ukulele there, but zither duet.
Mandolin's close.
And then there's nothing for a hammer dulcimer. That would really be that would be getting into it. But so the. There's so many marches Sousa wrote, like you know, the Monty Python, the one they use for that. That's a Sousa march.
That's a Sousa march.
The name escapes me, but
he did Washington Post. I know that one.
Mm-hmm.
Did he do all the, or most of the military marches? Right, like the Marine Corps hymn and.
I believe so.
Because that one right there may actually reveal more about his leanings, because, you know, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, about American, you know, imperialism. But it sounds like they're reading the Declaration of Independence now, so I don't want to hold you up much longer.
This is a good segment, good startup, good kickoff.
I love it. Eric? It was perfect. So thank you so much for stopping by.
Yeah.
And enjoy the rest of the
And I really enjoyed the as you know, you could say that in that Woodman Museum, they have Rough Riders, at least one Rough Rider full uniform. Someone from the area was in the group.
That's awesome.
John Philip Sousa's marches are emblematic of how the United States was feeling about its place in the world as the turn of the 20th century approached. There was a significant demographic that felt strongly about America joining the leading nations of the world in imperialist ventures, and whether Sousa himself felt that way or not, his marches seemed to add melody to the images of those who did. I spoke with the next segment's guest, Nye, at the New Hampshire Council for the Social Studies Conference this fall in Concord. hardly the setting that usually gets people thinking about the Beach Boys. But all the talk about politics and geography, culture and history, got them on our minds. And whether they like it or not, the Southern California group and their music are perfect reflections of how and why the United States had developed by the 1960s.
Well, this is making me think of, this is such a random tangent, but it's making me think of my first year. I studied at Scotland my first year of school, and wrote a paper on transnational fascism. And an interesting part of that was in, like, Greece, for example, I think it was, or Russia, a lot of countries were so focused on keeping their population nationalized that they would promote their own ski resorts or their own state parks as, like, this pop culture thing, being like, instead of saying travel abroad, they're like, stay home.
Stay in Switzerland.
Go to Switzerland. You know, like, stay in Russia. Go to this ski resort.
That's interesting.
So it's an interesting part of that.
And to think of something as, I've personally never been skiing. Nobody wants to see me ski. Because at this point, I'd have to start with the little kids. Like, I'd be the giant next to these kids learning the bunny slope thing. But, like, I can only imagine that with, when it comes to that kind of thing, that it seems so free and easy, right? Like, oh, just ski.
Go do it.
But to make it, like you just said, such a nationalized thing.
How charged it can be.
Yeah, that's I mean, we have, in this country, I would say, with Ski the East, right? Promoting the mountains in Vermont and New Hampshire in particular, and New York, versus going always to the Rockies, you know, is an alternative. But that's kind of a friendly competition kind of thing. It's not as nationalized. Well, let's talk about something that's actually not really related to skiing. I don't think Beach Boys ever took part in that. You want to talk about the Beach Boys?
Yeah.
Not the first time I've ever talked about the Beach Boys on this show, but I'm always willing to, because, like we were saying before we record, they're not just tied to the beach, are they? Or summertime?
No, they're not. Yeah, I know not a ton, but from my one military history class, which I was in love with, is about how there was a huge music shift, like, around the Vietnam War era, and you can see how that music changed, not only in, like, the lyrics, the messages that were being promoted, but also just, like, tonal shifts, the length of songs, and so a lot of that was, like, super interesting to me, and it was very engaging, especially for being in high school. You know, it's so easy to get lost in a teacher's lectures, but it's fun, listen to lyrics and, like, actually get to dissect it yourself.
So the question that I pulled, and I don't know if you want to talk about a specific Beach Boys song or just them as a group, because within the time frame of the 60s into the 70s, they morphed into pretty much a starter version of what we still have with the Beach Boys, which is, like, more of like a corporation than really a band.
Interesting.
Where you had, you know, Brian Wilson, for as much as he's a music genius, had a lot of emotional and mental health problems that kept him from wanting to go out on the road.
Yeah.
So he kind of stayed home and wrote the music, composed it, but wouldn't perform it.
Yeah.
Then you had the performance wing of the Beach Boys, which was headed by Mike Love and the rest of the brothers Wilson, and then a rotating group of outsiders. You know, so it started as a family project, turned into, you know, these musical wizards by the 70s.
Yeah.
And I actually just saw the Beach Boys, the Beach Boys band, for the third or fourth time this past summer. We went to California.
Yeah.
And among the things that we did in California was we stopped at their childhood home, where they have a big plaque out front saying this is where the Beach Boys used to live. But we also saw the Beach Boys at a Vineyard amphitheater in Paso Robles, and that band, still fronted by Mike Love, and there's Bruce Johnston, who joined the group in the 60s, he's still with them, but the rest of a bunch of other guys, it's not the Beach Boys from before. The most of the audience, I think that my son, who's 8 years old, brought down the average age of the audience to about 68 years old. So most of the audience would fit into the generation that was their original fans.
Yes.
What was the baby boomers, what was their main conflict? What military conflict are they most connected to?
Well, obviously coming out of World War II, and so, but leading into the Cold War, it's like, that's very formative. So they're coming out of such a big war, but then they're still going into this political conflict that might not be as physical, but very much ideological. And then going into the Vietnam War, obviously. And the Vietnam War is much longer than I think we think about it in history. Like, it actually is happening from, like, kind of the 50s into the 70s. And my history teacher used to be like, what's the longest war in American history? And we're always like, oh, the Afghan War. War on Terror. And he's like, it's technically the Vietnam War. Because of, you were looking at how long we were a part of it. And so those baby boomers are really built into that.
And I think there's, like you said, the Beach Boys are, they change a lot.
Yeah.
From in just a few years, you know, 64 to 70, mm-hmm. it's like two totally different groups.
Yeah.
And what your argument is right now, your thesis is that it was the Vietnam War.
I think it was a big part of it.
That really contributed to that. Could you extrapolate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think there was such. I think also the Vietnam War, but also we saw the civil rights movement happening in the 60s. And so there's so much revolution happening at this time and so much apprehension, a lot from the left towards the right, and beginning more political polarization. And I think that was really lighting a fire under a lot of people that maybe weren't talking as much before, but they wanted to feel involved, you know. And I think, to my understanding, that's what I would argue is what happened a little bit with the Beach Boys, is that they wanted to make a voice, not just be this cute pop band, you know, but like do something political, do something revolutionary.
And what's interesting is that, the very first time I saw them, or the modern version of it, and I feel so silly because when I saw them like taking the stage, I said to my wife, I'm like, I think I see Brian Wilson. It totally wasn't him because he had nothing. I've seen Brian Wilson since then, but it looked nothing like the guy that I thought was Brian Wilson. Is it some guy playing keyboards or something? But I saw them at Niagara Falls, at a Native American casino at Niagara Falls, an outdoor. It was a free concert. We just had to get there early enough to get our seats, and then we got to see the Beach Boys. And I remember when they introduced a certain song, they said, "This is our patriotic anthem." And they said, "It's not what you think it is. It's not Surfing USA. It's even more close to home than that. It's not even California Girls. It's even more close to home than that." They said, "This is called Be True to Your School." And they played that song. And I love it. I think it's a cool song, all the versions of it. I tell him right away, now what's the matter, buddy? Ain't you heard of my school? It's number one in the state. But I used that song on my test for U.S. history class when we learned about the 60s, because I'm like, the reason why you even have giant high schools that are basically, they're large enough to be patriotic about, is the same exact trends that made a rock and roll audience, that made an entire... So it's basically the boomers' life, like because of the baby boomers and because of the way that migration took place in the country internally. I mean, Southern California it's always been growing in population. I think currently is the only time period that they're actually losing population in the last 150 years.
Yeah.
But they've always been growing population for entertainment. But in the 50s, 60s, that military-industrial complex brought... You know, there's a lot of aerospace in Southern California.
Yeah.
There's weapons factories. You know, it makes it sound like there's, you know, rolling out the tanks and stuff, but they're not.
But we've like seen that progression.
You know, that's what people are moving there for. And so the culture of being at the beach and having fun, that's always there. But you also have a place for larger schools. And then when they're done with high school, if they stay within the university system of California, they have places like Berkeley, which I think they've had some demonstrations at Berkeley before. I don't know. Maybe
I'm not positive.
One or two. Yeah. I mean, they're kind of known for that, right? UC Berkeley of always, you know, in the 60s, that's where all these, you know, demonstrations and protests and marches and everything were happening. So it's all like kind of buckled together. And then you have, by the end of the decade, the Beach Boys seeming to kind of give in to it, because they, I think, I remember hearing a song, a radio, I don't know what it was exactly, they were ranking the most conservative pop songs ever written. I think the number two was Wouldn't It Be Nice by the Beach Boys, because it speaks about a couple that's in love, but they're not ready to give in to, you know, not until we're married, right?
Yeah.
We're going to wait till we're married to do all the things that couples do. And So they kind of have that presence in the time period of like being, you know, good old boy, you know, good boys, and they, you know, they definitely weren't, but, you know, they were the nice guys, and they weren't as wild as that exotic band, the Beatles, you know, coming in from England. And so it's kind of weird when they write a song called Student Demonstration Time, which, if you know the song I'm talking about, it even has kind of a wild grinding guitar to it. It's not a traditional, let's go to the beach, get your surfboard, you know, kind of thing. So are we saying that this is all like in you can take the timeline of the 60s and the early 70s, put the Beach Boys on it, and you're saying...
I have no idea, honestly. I cannot tell you as a historian that that's true, but like, based off my own small knowledge and like this conversation, I totally believe that. And looking at other historical events in history and how you can see such strong correlations from like looking at literature to history events, looking at music to history events, I no doubt think there's definitely some correlation at least that's strong.
There's also the component of, because you were mentioned before about militarism and the growth of the military. I myself am a military brat. I was I was born into an Air Force family. I was born overseas because of that, actually. Yeah. So I was, and we moved around, not nearly as much as some of my friends did, but we did move around some. And I remember seeing somebody fairly recently pointing at, you know, that fake song that people sing about like setting jingle bells in for Batman, like that whole song. The person, their argument was that they credit it to Vietnam War era military bases, because unlike previous conflicts, by the time the Vietnam War, the reason why the country fought the war the way that it did is because by that point we had a large standing military.
Yeah.
We had one that was present in all corners of the world.
Yep.
It wasn't like, even after World War II, we downsized the military, and that's why Korea required another draft again, because we didn't have a large standing military. But by the 60s, big military, you have base housing, which didn't really exist before the 60s and the 50s, and families, the entire family unit is shifting around, sometimes even the globe. So pop culture things, whether it be a silly song about Batman or Beach Boys songs, you know, Southern California music and stuff, is spread a lot quicker and wider because of, like, you know, the group America. You would know.
Okay.
The Horse with No Name, that song, I've been through the desert, the horse with no name. That's America.
Okay.
They were Air Force brats as well. They grew up in London.
Okay.
Or outside of London, an Air Force base. And I saw them in concert a couple years ago. They're fantastic. They played all their great, you know, Ventura Highway is my favorite one by them. Sister Golden Hair. They're a great band from, their first album came out in 1970.
Mm.
They said, being in London in the late 60s was amazing. We got to see the Rolling Stones, we got to see The Who, we got to see all these, you know, when Jimi Hendrix came to England from America, we got to see them. But they also, because they were base kids, because they were connected to the American military, they had access to the American records before their English friends did.
Mm.
So they were the go-to for all the English kids off base. If they wanted to hear the latest American music, they would go to these guys first.
Interesting.
And so they had that early access to it. And, you know, because the 60s, one of the reasons why the music of the 60s is so phenomenal is because of that trade back and forth across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
When you were in Scotland, you probably saw evidence of that, that it hasn't ceased.
Yeah.
We continue to ping pong our culture back and forth.
A lot of it.
What were some examples that you saw?
I'm trying to think like specifically, but just a lot in the culture of the people I felt, like of the students and the population, it felt very much like I was still an American in some ways, you know, like there wasn't a huge cultural divide between how me and other students at the time had like pop culture experience. The songs we liked, the media we were into felt very similar. That's the first thing that comes to mind. But then there were some differences, like academically, that was very interesting to me. Like even in the way we write as like students, that was a part that I felt like there was a divide. But overall, I felt like a lot of those kids that grew up in England, their whole lives I'd never known, felt a lot like me, even though across the ocean, you know.
Yeah, that we have that shared. and
upbringing,
media,
in a way.
Like you yes. said, and pop culture has such a huge part of that because we can all gravitate towards it, especially English language stuff, you know, because yeah. like it's, I have a friend who's he's from Turkey. He studied in the United States mm-hmm. for a while, so I came to know him. And he used to comment, he said, Americans don't really know world music very much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's like, in Turkey, we listen to a lot of American pop yes. music, but we also have a lot of our own that Americans don't know anything about.
Yeah.
And I, you know, kind of defending the rest of my country, I'm like, well, first of all, we produce a lot here at yes. home, so we don't always need to go outside of our
bounds.
Our borders mm-hmm. to get other music. But also, you know, because we're such a big country, there's not as much of a drive for people to learn other languages. Yeah. So if we hear a song that's completely in a foreign language, you know, it's not like we're bigots or something. We just,
yeah.
I don't know what they're saying. So I don't want to be blasting from my radio
yeah.
something that could be saying something totally awful or weird.
Yeah. I think also, like, America, just our international influence, like going to, you know, living in Scotland, like those kids understood the political sphere yeah. of America at the time very
better
well,
than
better than us. But I, it took me a minute to get adjusted to like their parliament, understanding their political conflicts, understanding how their system worked. And I was, it wasn't a culture shock or anything, but I was definitely like, oh, they know American culture way more than me. And that's because it's embedded into their lives.
Right.
Whereas in America, it's not.
We don't have Scottish culture as much.
Very little.
I spent about 9 hours of my life in Scotland about 10 years ago, and it was beautiful. I loved Edinburgh. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, we went to a pub, and I just happened to have a shirt that said New Hampshire on it. And so the first guy that talked to me, he's like, oh, he's like, that's where you have Baron Witches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, not anymore. Like, you know, that's really, he's like, that's like New England is, you know, to them, the witch area.
Yeah.
He was joking, of course. But then later on, we were talking to the, you know, the barkeep, and he was just telling us, he's like, about their politics over there, and he's
yeah.
like, about, you know, because this is around the time when Scotland was once again talking about a separation from
yep.
English and having their
yep.
own parliament, and having
still are,
and that,
yeah.
and he's like, and I won't do the accent for him, but he's like, I'm in a difficult spot. He's like, my mother's English, my father's Scottish, so I'm kind of divided, but he pointed out in our own history, he's like, it's sort of like you in America with in this, you know, the North and the South,
yeah.
you know, and that's something that has never really gone away. I mean,
yeah.
It's still there.
Still very much,
you know,
there.
Reconstruction still goes on. It's amazing what a conversation about the Beach Boys
can lead to.
And I have to say, I'm so, you're not the first person that's in college that I've spoken to for this podcast. I am so just overjoyed by the way that people are thinking
mm-hmm.
in college.
Yeah.
It's such a, you know, I hate to say, I think a lot of times people have a stereotype about
yeah.
what college campuses look like nowadays and what goes on there. And I don't think that it's a, you're an exception to the rule.
Yeah.
You're an exceptional person, but you're not an exception to the rule as far
yeah.
as the kind of thinking
yes.
that is happening there and the kind of critical
yeah.
thoughts that are coming
agree.
Out.
Totally.
I really appreciate you coming
by. Of course.
By
thank you. Thank you for having
this.
Me.
Yeah.
It was really enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you
I
very much.
It.
It was fantastic being at a social studies conference, and as of the publication of this podcast, I'm 1 week away from presenting at another one, the National Council for Social Studies, and their conference, coincidentally in Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Check out everything-history.com for more details, and follow me on social media for updates from the conference itself. My booth at the NHCSS conference was next to that of Fred Bramante, the founder of Competency-Based Education Standards, and we had great conversations throughout the day. As a disclaimer about my feeling ignorant of not knowing who Fred is for the duration of the conference, I was going on my 10th year of being a resident of New York State when Fred ran for governor of New Hampshire in 2000, and was only 9 years old when he moved to the Empire State from the Granite One. Not really old enough to be aware that he was the founder of Daddy's Junkie Music in 1966. Daddy's was a New England used instrument chain that was open until 2007. I should have connected those dots when he was showing me all the photos of him and rock stars. Anyhow, here's some of the recorded part of our talk.
We were talking again before, you know, as we were setting up today, about the power of music.
Yep.
And particularly the 1960s.
Yep.
And I think about Bob Dylan.
Yep.
You mentioned him. He
yep.
performed at the March on Washington, which just celebrated its 60th anniversary a few months ago, in August of 1963. He, along with other musicians, Joan Baez was there. They played Eyes on the Prize and We Shall Overcome as part
yep.
of the day's performance. So he was, that day was crafted to be the pinnacle, or like the meeting point of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of a gathering, here's our mission, here's what we're going to do. We're
yep.
celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation. We have Abraham Lincoln, who I just mentioned, behind a little bit more about that.
This is a story that I heard that at one of the early Beatles shows, that Dylan was backstage and met John Lennon for the first time. And John Lennon asked him what he thought of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And Dylan's response was, well, it's, you know, it's nice, but you guys have nothing to say. Which, if you know the Beatles and know John Lennon, then you can imagine that totally bummed him out.
Right.
And then, because he obviously had so much to say.
Right.
And you start thinking about the difference between those first couple of Beatles albums, that Please Please Me and I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You. And then all of a sudden, these albums went in a totally different direction.
Yeah.
And they started getting way heavier and way, you know, way more thoughtful. And then, for the who were thought of the American version of the Beatles or the rival, the Beach Boys, then it upped their game too.
Yeah.
Instead of being just surfing and drag racing songs and girlfriend songs, that all of a sudden, you know, that Pet Sounds album for the Beach Boys became the Beach Boys version of trying to up the game.
Right. They were, it was Rubber Soul that did that for them, and then they passed it back to the Beatles, who came up with Sgt. Pepper.
Exactly.
And, you know, sent that back. So it was almost like, you know, an extended version of like being pen pals with somebody.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
like, here's our.
But what a great competition. But I want to go back even further,
mm-hmm.
okay? I went to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, the Lorraine
yeah.
Motel, where Martin Luther King was shot.
Yep.
And, you know, you get to go through, you see the room, you can see into the room where he was shot. And it's got a glass wall, but, you know, with the next room, so you can see. And the room has been left exactly the way Martin Luther King and those that were with him left it.
Right.
And, and we went through the museum, and I walked out of that museum, and I said to myself, something is missing here. And I called the curator of the museum, and I said, you know, I love the museum. I think there's something missing. And I said that if you look in Time magazine's their millennium issue, that they had the 1,000, they had the top 100 events of the last 1,000 years.
Mm.
And one of those events was the birth of rock and roll. And in their picture, you know, for that section was early Elvis.
Okay.
And when Elvis first hit, and if you've seen the movie, have you seen the Elvis movie?
Not the most recent one.
Oh, you need to see the Elvis movie.
Okay.
It's really
I kind great. Of have a, I don't particularly like the director of that movie and his movies, so I've stayed away from. My wife said it was very good, but I'm not a big
Baz Luhrmann fan.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that.
Well, I want to tell you, I think the movie's excellent. So anyway, it shows Elvis, and, you know, growing up as a poor kid in the South, living in, largely, black complexes.
Yeah.
And learning music from those that he lived with.
Right.
And growing up with that. And then you have Sam Phillips, who I also met.
Right.
Sam Phillips.
Oh, you met him. Okay.
Oh, yep. I hung out with Sam one night. And
at a Holiday Inn, probably, because he was a shareholder in that company.
Yeah, well, I know the story behind that, too. Jack, what's his name? I forget his last name. I'll think of it in a minute. Was the guy that really founded that.
Yeah,
but down
he was
in
a
Memphis
guy, too. Yeah.
And Sam Phillips, who was the founder of Sun Records, he had this little record company down south that was largely recording black music.
Right.
And Rufus Thomas, B.B. King, so many artists.
Alan Wolf. Yeah.
Ike Turner. And he knew that music, that white kids were listening to that music mm-hmm. on these small watt radio stations, the black radio stations, and because the big watt stations, those were white radio stations.
Right.
The little watt, those were black music stations. But he knew that white kids were listening to it, and so he knew that if he could find a white kid
yeah.
who really knew how to sing that music, that he could make $1 million.
Right.
Which back then was a lot of money.
Yeah, well, I would take it.
So he was actively looking for Elvis. And his secretary, Marion Kiesker was her name, she said, well, what about that nice boy that came in to make a record for his mother mm-hmm. for her birthday? So, fine, Sam was desperate. Brought him back in. And it was actually the second time they brought him back in. It wasn't enough the first time. He didn't find it. Second time, in playing with Bill Black and Scotty Moore, Bill Black on bass, Scotty Moore on guitar, who were session musicians at Sun, they asked Elvis, what kind of stuff do you like? So Elvis played. Elvis said, played That's All Right, Mama. And the rest is history, as they say.
So I'll show you this real quick.
Yeah, they went nuts. Oh, I love it. They went nuts over Elvis's version of that song, called Sam in. Sam, you got to hear this. Played it for Sam. Sam flipped. Said, "That's it. Record that right now, and I'm going to bring it over to the local station, with the local DJ Dewey Phillips, who was not related." But Dewey was a fan of Sun, and brought it over to Dewey. Dewey played the song. The phones lit up with half of the calls saying, "Oh my God, that's fantastic! Who is that? Play that again." And the other half of the calls, "Hey, we don't play that N-word music on our radio station." And to which Dewey Phillips would respond, "Oh, no, no, this is a white kid. He's from Humes High School here in Memphis, and this is his name." And
there he is.
And so that all of a sudden started. It was a legitimate way for the kind of music that was being created by black musicians to start to get played on big watt radio stations. Mm. And the kids went crazy over it, and they want more and more and more. And the kids my age didn't care whether a musician was black or white. They loved the music so much. So all of a sudden, Elvis cracked open that door that allowed Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Fats Domino, all those guys to walk through mm-hmm. because they were relegated to these small stations, and all of a sudden, this thing gets opened up, and the whole country goes crazy for rock and roll. So to me, when I called the museum, the Civil Rights Museum, yeah. I said, you guys haven't paid enough tribute to the importance, the role that rock and roll
Just down the street from you, in fact.
That's right.
Yeah. The
importance, that the role that rock and roll played in opening this up, because kids my age did not care whether it was a white artist or a black artist. They just loved it.
That's what I was gesturing towards my picture. I've been to Sun Records. It was on the same trip. It was a road trip that we took from New Hampshire out to Arizona and then back again. And on the way out, we stopped in Cleveland and we went to, because that's where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is. Yep. We didn't go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on that trip. I've been there before. But the reason why that is there is because Alan Freed and the Moondog Show, he coined the term rock and roll and had the very first rock and roll concert was in Cleveland. And my family and I were cemetery nuts. We love going to cemeteries, especially famous graves. And Alan Freed is buried not terribly far from where President Garfield's mausoleum is and John D. Rockefeller's, Lakeview Cemetery in Cleveland, Ohio. And his marker, it looks like a jukebox.
Oh, no kidding.
And it has a picture of him on it. And on the backside, it explains the value of rock and roll. And it mentions that in there, how it was universally enjoyed. It saw no race. It didn't see, went beyond music.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
So, you know, I took pictures of that. We enjoyed our time there.
Think about it changed the world. The one of the top 100 events of the last 1,000 years.
Is,
the birth of rock and roll.
We could even, though, take issue, no pun intended, with that issue of Life magazine, because that's a very modern view of things, where if you were to give that same task to somebody 100 years, 200 years before, obviously they wouldn't have been able to include Elvis in there, but they might have a different perspective of what's important. But yes, rock and roll, social movement beyond just music movement. On our way back, we went to Memphis, and we had a choice to make because we only had so much time. And I said, we're either going to go to Graceland or we're going to go to Sun Studios. And because I'm a fan of not just Elvis, but I also love Johnny Cash. I love
Roy Orbison.
I love all that Sun Records stuff.
Yep.
We went there, and it was a wonderful tour. They make
Carl
sure they hit all the Carl
Jerry
Perkins,
Lee Lewis,
you name it. You know, the $1 Million Quartet, basically.
Yep.
We went through the tour, and the tour guy was fantastic. He gave a wonderful. We went to the studio, which is still a working studio. They still record there. And he gave a demonstration of how they, you know, did the music and everything. And then on our way out, I told him the decision that we made. And he's like, you made the right choice. You know, Graceland, it is what it is. Here is it was so much more raw and genuine.
Yeah, it's like the birthplace.
But that's exactly what I said to him, because on the same trip, we have Alan Freed's grave. Cleveland is the birth of rock and roll. Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis is the birth of rock and roll. I'm like, it can't be both. And the tour guide, he was great, but he was like, yeah, you know, I think
Elvis was a little earlier, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's almost like they have a greater stake to it because of their presence in, bring it back to Bob Dylan, proximity to Highway 61, right? The blues highway that goes up and down. So it's quite literally the meeting place of rhythm and blues is Memphis.
Yep.
And, you know, there's the place, and being right on the Mississippi River, which has always been a lifeline for the whole country, you know, that music goes in all directions immediately, right? It leaves the South and goes to the North. It goes to, you know, the West. It goes all these different places. So I don't think the parts of our conversation are all that separate from each other. The civility component of it, we look at the 60s a lot of times and the kind of raucous behavior that rock and roll created as being one of the reasons that there was a drive in the 1968 election to bring the country back to civility. But when we compare it to the modern day, I don't know. It's kind of, I think that you at least had enough people back then, including musicians, who were all about, yes, we need to come back to being normal people towards each other.
The marches were peaceful.
Right.
Right? I mean, you
dressed
know, it's
nicely.
Like, yeah, it, you know, so things, not that we haven't had terrible things go on forever.
Right. It's just human nature, it seems.
But I really think that, and I don't know if they've done anything since, but I really think that rock and roll deserves its place in the Civil Rights Museum.
Mm-hmm. And there's actually, and we'll end with this, but there's a few places that take claim as Civil Rights Museum. There's another one in, the name escapes me, in North Carolina. There's the Woolworth building that was the lunch counter.
There, oh, wow.
There's another Civil Rights Museum there.
Okay.
And then there's the Lorraine Motel.
Yep.
And it's interesting that those kinds of places, pop culture places, Woolworth is a national company,
yep.
At least was. Motels, that's Americana, that's,
yep.
And we were just saying before, Holiday Inn is from Memphis. It's like the venues that we use for museums now, we see it so much differently, because we want that realness. We don't want, instead of a separate building completely built to be a museum. It's just interesting to me that one of the Civil Rights Museums is a place where the movement received probably its most significant blow dealt to it by the death of its leader, that it's not necessarily where another location that might make more sense, like his birthplace or the church he preached at, one of the churches he preached at would be used. It's we'll end by asking you, why do you think that they chose the Lorraine Motel as the location for the Civil Rights Museum?
Well, obviously because of Martin Luther was killed there, what they've done is. I'm assuming you haven't been there.
No, we only had so much time in Memphis, and that was on my list of things
really,
I wanted to see.
They've gutted the entire place,
yeah.
Okay? So you can go see the room that was Martin Luther King's room.
Did they preserve it from that day onwards, or did they go back and recreate it?
No, I think they preserved it from that day.
Okay.
There's still, glass, on the table they were using. I think there might be a bottle of Coca-Cola. There might, some of the state that the bed was in. I think the bed was. I don't know if the bed was messed up or not. But
mm-hmm.
Whatever the state was of that room upon that moment, as I understand it, is still intact. And then they gutted the rest of it. So room 237, nobody cares about, right?
I mean,
all they care about is that room where Martin Luther King is. So the facade of the Lorraine Motel is still there. It still looks like a motel. The cars that were out in front, I'm sure they're not the exact same cars, but they've got pictures of what it was like that day. So they've put other cars. They've gone out and found, another 58 Plymouth or whatever it was,
right.
and that's there. So they've tried to make the scene the same as it was at that moment that Martin Luther King was shot. But everything behind the facade is a museum. It's all mm-hmm. different, new, and so it's.
It really just demonstrates an awareness that they had then in that moment in the late 60s.
This was a special place.
Yeah, that they that
sacred, is, almost it's, sacred.
It's very visionary to be like, immediately after this happens, we're going to use this place
Absolutely.
As a teaching moment,
yep.
And that's. It's so modern. It's
yep.
so different from,
yep.
Previous time periods. Because that's a lot of museums are like that now, right? Where they'll carve out a place that something happened and use that as, instead of building a whole new structure for it, it's like, here's this building that's, very important to our, and so therefore that is very revealing of the time period, just
yep.
like the music that you said perhaps was missing. We could go on all day.
Oh, yeah, I could talk about this stuff forever.
We kind of did before we went on, but I really appreciate you taking the time to record with me.
My pleasure.
And hopefully this isn't the last time we talk. This
anytime you want.
So thank you again. And just one last quick, because I'm going to try to air this before the event so that people might be able to. January 11th, 2024. Where should they go to if they want to stream it?
Go to the website first. Go to our website, which is Civics and Civility, spelled out A-N-D, civicsandcivility.org.
Okay.
And you'll see what the event is about. It's been endorsed by Governor Sununu, endorsed by Senator Shaheen, nonpartisan. We're going to have limited a number of folks that we can fit in the venue. So if your school would like to participate, please get in touch with us. My email is fbramante, B-R-A-M-A-N-T-E, at N as in Nancy, C-C, Charlie, B-L, boy, Larry, .org, nccbl.org, fbramante at nccbl.org. Get in touch with me and let's try and get your school in there before the thing fills up.
We'll try our best to make an impact through here.
And I don't know if I mentioned, so kids that participate in person are going to be the original signers of the Declaration of Civility.
And they're making a primary source by doing that. It's a document. Thank you again so much.
There's a good chance that Fred Storr allowed for the guest in the final segment to make music in the Seacoast region of New Hampshire in the 1990s. Tom stopped by my table in Prescott Park this spring during their annual Chowderfest. It was an event made even more special because it was held on the same day as the Portsmouth 400th Anniversary Grand Parade. Tom is a musician and came to Portsmouth, like so many other Gen Xers, because he wanted to take part in the vibrant art scene in the city in the 1990s. The Elvis Room, a hip coffee shop and music venue, was one of his favorite spots, as it was for so many other 20 and 30-somethings of the era.
The very special 400th for Portsmouth, and we were just chatting before I hit record that you came here probably around year number
97. Yeah. So what's 97, 98? Just call it 25 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So 375.
So you've been part of it for a little while. And what drew you to Portsmouth?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, it was the music scene, which... So I grew up around Plymouth, New Hampshire, and all the bands were coming up to that area. I graduated in 92 in the high school. And so it seemed like there was a lot going on. I moved away, and a friend of mine decided, hey, let's go back here. There's stuff going on, we thought, at that point.
It seemed like there was. I mean,
It was tapering off by the time I returned, but yeah.
What do you think was the reason for it starting and ending the way that it did? Because it seemed like just the entire 1990s was the era when downtown Portsmouth had, led by the Elvis Room, a really thriving, local music scene.
Yeah, it's hard to know, not having been there at the beginning of it. It definitely seems... I think besides the college being close by, it seems like there was a handful of local musicians that just were all of a similar age and found each other and started putting things together and created a pretty healthy scene.
Yeah, and it's...
As far as its demise, maybe, just because, that moment, those people just, got to the age where moved on to whatever.
I remember, because I teach high school locally, and it seems like it's coming back a little bit with students have their own bands, garage bands and stuff like that. When I was in high school in the 90s, every school, even the smallest ones, seemed to have like four or five different bands that actually, would play. Yeah. And that tapered off a lot
around 2000s, you know, the early 2000s, it seemed like there just wasn't motivation or anything like that. And it seems like it's back now. And so it's like there are some groups I hear kids talking, oh, yeah, so-and-so's playing out tonight. And I'm like, okay, cool, it's back.
Right.
Because it seemed to be that was such a great outlet for a very long, really long time for young people in particular.
It's a great social thing.
Yeah.
You know, to rally around, you know, one experience.
Yeah. And like I have the video going that I was showing you from a feature that they did on TV about the Elvis Room. And as important as it was here in New Hampshire, here in Portsmouth, I feel like there was places like that all around.
Yeah.
That was like the 90s were just so vibrant with creativity, and like Gen X was like, you know, what can we kind of assume about that generation? People that were born in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to, you know, think about it that way. I you know, was born in 74 and certainly was into music, but, you know, MTV came along and probably, you know, influenced a lot of people, I guess. You know, I mean, at that time, certainly growing up, there were less distractions. Where I grew up, we didn't have cable and I got two channels.
Yeah.
It wasn't TV, you know. But I would find music through magazines and stuff like that. But so I guess I wonder if it just had to do with less distractions, the video age, and just creating that desire.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sort of like, and MTV gets a lot of flack these days, it seems, you know, for tapering off the actual music videos
around
the same time. You know, late 90s is when I noticed it, that they were going a lot
so
more.
So it was
towards
whatever that beat show was, is Jersey Shore.
Yeah,
we're going to blame Jersey Shore for the end of a live music.
They pretty much did. And I remember, I've talked about it before with other people about this on my podcast, about how Beavis and Butthead were like, they were great in the 90s because they were, everybody around them and everything that they watched was actually like a step or two better than them, like intellectually. they came, it was a funny show because they came off as dummies because everybody else was smarter than them. And then somewhere, and then they went away for a while and then they came back in 2007. By that point, and when they came back, they were watching shows like Jersey Shore and other stuff. And they came off, they had remained exactly the same. They came off incredibly, like, coherent and smart compared to what they were watching. Like, Jersey Shore, I think, just lowered the standards so much.
Yeah.
And so it's like that era of MTV, because in its prime, they had some great shows. Like, it was 120 minutes.
Okay.
A lot of underground artists and stuff. A lot of, like, punk groups and things like that were featured on that. They had, like, Headbangers Ball, so they had the heavy metal.
Yeah, so, where I grew up, we couldn't have cable.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in central New Hampshire, and but I would go visit my grandmother in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I'd watch MTV the whole time. But she started videotaping it late at night for me and sending me videotapes.
Oh, really?
So I got Headbangers Balls and all
that's
sorts
awesome
of stuff like that. Yeah.
So is that so telling? Because Portsmouth, because of its physical location, its actual geography, has long been, as far as popular culture goes, the recipient of, like, I don't think there's maybe one or two actual TV channels out of here, but not currently. Because Portland has a few channels.
Okay.
Boston has a few. And we're definitely feeling it with the wind coming off the water right now. We're on the coastline.
Yeah.
So therefore, they would get and this is like from the 50s onwards. So like people in Portsmouth actually had, without cable, plenty of channels to choose from.
Gotcha.
And so I'm imagining, you know, and I know living in Portsmouth in the 80s and stuff, we got cable. And that MTV was off limits for me because I was a young kid. But that probably laid the groundwork for, you know, young people watching television, seeing these bands that were, you know, it's kind of like the Johnny Appleseed effect. Like, they were like, oh, I could do that. Like, that's right. Not, they're not playing the kind of music that is out of, you know, like, when you started playing music, were you setting your sights, like, or did you just kind of, like, climb a ladder as far as your own abilities?
Musicianship?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still climbing that ladder. But no, I mean, I don't know when I guess you know, I just always loved the feeling of music.
Yeah.
That's what it was for me. And so I guess when I started to actually play, I always kind of knew I wanted to be a musician. Like, from the age I was 7, I was like,
yeah,
you know, that's happening. And, but, once I got into it and really started playing, my vision became whatever comes into my head at any moment, I want to reproduce.
Right.
And I want to be there, any filter with that flow.
That's awesome.
So, but I'm not there.
But as far as like, when it comes to making music of your own, and I'm glad to know that you have that kind of mindset of like, I'll make original music. You know,
well, honestly, it wasn't always my mindset.
Oh, really?
My mindset was just to play with people, feel that synergy. And so, you know, as a bass player, I've done a lot of freelance, right?
Fellow bass player. I play bass, too. Not very well, but I do play it.
That's okay. But, you know, I mean, it's getting that feel.
Yeah.
And that's what, as a, you know, for me as a musician, I'm trying to get that with everybody.
Right.
Right? It's not just... over my place in Kittery, and
nice.
With the intention of essentially doing something similar, ultimately focusing on the Seacoast area. You know, I have the domain seacoastmusic.com.
Okay.
But it's not up and running yet. But then the whole point of that is to showcase, essentially, I'd love to make the Seacoast a physical and virtual destination for music, highlighting
great.
The local artists.
That would be great. And as we can hear, I think there's plenty of other people that would be interested in doing the same. So,
yeah.
You know, it's like I like that term, the torch that was lit, you know, like kind of like that.
Say that again.
The torch was lit a long time ago. It's still burning.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back.
There's always things bubbling up. And, you know, it's amazing how many concentric, you know, as a freelance player, you find yourself in all these different circles. And there's all this, you know, concentric part of it,
yeah.
That inner, you know, that... There's always something that's further out of the circle that you find yourself
right.
in. And it's amazing how much is out there.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for being willing to do this. I spotted you in the crowd, and I'm like, that guy can definitely hold a conversation.
Yeah. Now,
so.
I'm just hoping that my wife hasn't checked off the rest of my chowder boxes yet.
Well, I'll let you get back to the Chowder Fest.
All right.
While it still has.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Music is a great primary source to use in order to learn about time and place because technically it has incredibly quick turnaround time. True, John Philip Sousa probably spent more time writing all the notes for his Stars and Stripes Forever than a punk band did for a live show 100 years later, but all those things you want to know about time and place are evident in all pop music. So, as Madonna says, music is what blends together the ordinary folk with the renegades. Her observations of this in the late hours of the 20th century really does reflect the amazing era of pop music that came before it. Join me next time on the EPS podcast, where everything, including all pop music, is a primary source.